the verge of bleeding out. Was I supposed to believe he'd now sifted in to prevent me from losing it? I narrowed my eyes and assessed Oz. I'd drawn conclusions while we'd talked. Not fey, not human, but magical, and smelling of earth, blood, and bones. There was an old earth god in my bedroom, and he'd cast a spell on me. And now there was a fey prince in my bedroom too, carefully muted at the moment, for which I was grateful. But who could say how long that would last? Oz despised Jane and, apparently, the entire fey race. I said to Oz's back, "You want my sword so you can use it to kill fey." He whirled on me, eyes narrowing to slits of green fire.
"Better us than them. Give it to me now, you fool."
In spite of myself, my hand arced upward.
"Danny, don't,"
Jane murmured. My hand dropped again. I'd have nearly liked Jane at that instant, if he hadn't added in a voice of coercion,
"You will give it to me instead."
My hand went back up, and my feet began a traitor's walk toward him. A puppet. I was their bloody puppet. It incensed me, enough to want to stab them both with the weapon they coveted. Oz said coldly, gaze fixed hungrily on my sword,
"My spell was first. Hand it to me now, child, or I will raise your motherfucking world."
Torn between commands, my hand went still, and I pondered its motionless state. Spell to my left, voice of power to my right. If they kept tugging at me, what might happen? Not to me, but them. Especially if I added my left hand into the mix. I eased black fingers around the hilt of the sword and laced my hands together. Jane's gaze fixed on the subtle coupling, then shot to my face, searchingly. Still, he continued to work at my will, as did Oz. I could feel ancient, inimical power rolling off them, and knew, though neither was speaking, both were furtively attempting to bend my hand their way. Excruciating pressure escalated inside my head, so I tucked the bulk of my brain into one of my boxes and braced myself. I'd learned long ago how to distance myself from pain. Two very different forms of power crept over my flesh, slithering under and around, seeking control. One brilliant and summery, one dark and earthy. Two arcane arts met on my hands, mingling perhaps with something of the hunter's ancient power, and mixed as badly as oil and water with an undercurrent of dynamite. There was a swirling tornado of magic gone bad building, growing larger and more flawed with each passing moment. Then abruptly, power exploded from my hands and slammed back into them. Jane roared and flinched. Oz shrieked and clawed at his face. Both turned to snarl at me. I shrugged, flexing my fingers to make sure they were under my control again. "You shouldn't try to take a woman's sword." Jane said sternly,
"Danny, that weapon is far more dangerous than you know. Only a fey can handle its power now."
Oz snorted,
"Don't listen to him. The fairies seduce and lie."
"But gods don't," I said derisively. His eyes narrowed and he gave me an appraising look.
"Perhaps not entirely a fool."
"Neither yours nor his," I warned. Jane said,
"Danny, what happened to your hand?" "Yes, what?"
Oz asked, eyes narrowing. "No clue." That was the truth, but I was done answering questions. I'd formed theories and I wanted answers. "Let me guess. The gods are back, awakened by the song. Long ago you warred with the fey. You've decided to start that war up again, and to do so, you need my sword."
"Pretty much,"
Jane said flatly. "And how long have you known this without bothering to tell any of us?" I fired at Jane.
"Not very,"
he said, bristling at my tone.
"They returned weak and hid, biding time until they regained power. Only recently have they begun to show themselves." We were weak because of what you did to us.
Oz hissed at him, then snarled at me.
We didn't start the war. They did. Turning your race against us. Once your race prayed to us and we listened. We were good to you. Once.
Try to take my sword again, you'll die.
I'm not the only one who'll come seeking it. Others won't be as generous as I. You don't want him to come after it. You never want him to come. It won't be only your sword he takes. Do yourself a favor and hand it over to me. You'll be glad you did. If he comes for you, you'll discover the true meaning of hell.
I let my eyes go empty and cold. I'm not afraid of hell. I lived there once. And if I have to go back again, I'll swagger through those gates with fire in my blood and war in my heart. And I'll take no prisoners. I meant it. I have little fear. I have a great deal of fury. Inequity, injustice, incites a slow burn inside me that consumes me with deference for neither self-injury nor casualties. I sometimes think I'm a hair trigger away from becoming something else. A thing I don't understand. Oz said sneeringly,
Good luck with that. His hell is a place you can't begin to imagine. Eternal. No escape.
Or, I said with acid sweetness, I could give my sword to Jane, and you could try to take it from a prince. But, oh, wait. If that were possible, you would have taken it the last time your race's ward. Seems to me, giving it to Jane would pretty much shut the old gods down.
Yes, Danny.
Jane said quietly.
It would.
Oz hissed.
You're so certain you prefer the human race answer to the fairy over us. We guided you. We didn't turn our backs on you until you betrayed us.
I prefer the human race answer to no one but itself. We don't need or want either of you. I'm standing here with two alien races, both vying for control over man.
We're native to this world, not alien.
Oz growled at the same time Jane cut me off with...
That's not true, Danny, and you know it. I once was human. I still hold the same hopes and fears for our race as you do, and adhere to the same priorities I once did.
Oz said derisively,
You're fey. You don't feel and you don't belong on our world.
This is our world, I said coolly. And as far as I'm concerned... Neither of you belong here, and I don't care if you were human once, Jay. You're not now.
Danny, I'll take the sword to the Queen,
Jane said. For which I have only your word. No thanks. I'll be keeping it. Or, I fished, dying to see Mac again. You could bring the Queen to me, and I'd consider handing it over. Jane was a mostly good man, with a fatal flaw. Well, two. One, he was a fey prince now. Two, he'd not been able to resist taking my sword once before for the sake of the common good. Pretty much every phrase that begins with the word common instills unease in me. Common knowledge, common good, common welfare. Somehow common man never seems to have much of a say in those common definitions. Politicians and kings make those decisions, and it's the common man who dies when kings go to war.
It seems we have an impasse,
Oz said with silky menace.
Two of us don't require sleep. You do.
He folded his arms over his chest.
It's only a matter of time, and we've an infinity of it. Once you've wearied, one of us will take the sword, or you may choose your successor.
I glanced at Jane and knew instantly he wasn't willing to wait that long. He was already changing, no longer concealing his power, but allowing the facade he'd adopted in order to shield me drop away infinitesimal bit by bit, permitting me time to cave before he turned the full, mind-numbing beauty and horror of a prince of the Court of Seasons on me. I shivered. Fae princes are sexual beyond human tolerance. They can instill desire in us, amplify it, feed off it, and throw it back at us, 1,000 times more potent than it began. It's too much for us. It chars a woman down to ash inside her own mind, leaving nothing but a willing slave. I might have run Jane through with the sword, if he hadn't already begun letting his glamour fall. Now, if I were to lunge for him, he'd simply blast me with the full strength of it. And I'd be on the floor, with no thought left of killing him in my smashed mind. You wouldn't, I said icily.
I'm sorry, Denny, but I don't dare let it fall into their hands. This isn't personal.
He'd said the same thing to me years ago when he left me lying in that trash-filled street. Spell check, I growled. When you do something to a person, it's personal. That's the funny thing about us persons. I laid down my mental grid and kicked up into the slipstream. Nothing happened. I sighed. Extreme emotion and extreme arousal can short out my she-seer powers, and it always happens at the worst possible times. I'd been working on the extreme emotion flaw and had made progress with it. It wasn't quite as easy to master the other fault. I had to get aroused to work on it, and, well, that hadn't happened in a while. I cast rapidly about for another option, finding only one. It was a long shot.
Give it to me now,
Oz commanded.
And I'll kill him with it. The fairy permit only slaves to live and demand worship. We aren't, and don't.
As Jane's glamour continued to fall by slow degrees, still allowing me time to hand it over willingly, I glanced down to where both of my hands were wrapped tightly around the hilt of my sword. I shuddered, as his inhuman sexuality began nudging the edges of my mind, looking for a sweet spot, an easy way in. He was trying to do as little damage as possible, for the moment. Shivering violently, teeth chattering, I ground out, "You're willing to shatter my mind for it? What do you think your queen will do to you?" My eyes blazed. I felt tears slip from them as I met his gaze, and didn't need a mirror to know I was weeping blood. He said sadly,
"Ah, Danny, she will most certainly kill me, but she will have the sword. I'm willing to die to protect our race and yours from these vermin."
He'd said our race and yours. There it was. I knew it. His allegiance was to the Fae, not us. I closed my eyes, grinding my teeth together against the cruel teeth of power now tearing aggressively into the edges of my mind. When I was younger, I experienced a Fae prince's compulsion twice, and survived. I was older and wiser now. I took my long shot, focused on the ice in my hand. I welcomed it, beckoned it to spread throughout my body, course through my veins with absolutely no idea what I was embracing. In a battle for your life, your sanity, your race, the weapon you have is the one you use. I felt a sudden prick of pins and needles through my entire body, a buzzing deep in my flesh, as if my limbs were waking up from a long time of being numb. My skin cooled and shivered on my bones, feeling strangely elastic and supple. Blood thunder crashed in my head, slamming against the confines of my skull, as whatever the hunter had left beneath my skin responded, and flexed, and grew. A wave of dizziness took me, and I nearly stumbled as sudden stars exploded behind my eyes, and I had a fleeting glimpse of a vast nebula-drenched nightscape superimposed in the air in front of me. Then it was gone, and the inside of my head felt calm and cool and silent as the deepest reaches of space. I didn't have time to analyze it, didn't think, just opened my eyes and flung my left hand at Inspector Jane. The prince sifted out a mere fraction of a second before the bolt of pale blue lightning exploded in the precise spot he'd been standing. The crackling energy struck the south wall of the room, blowing it apart from floor to ceiling. Plaster exploded, wood splintered, and bricks tumbled away, leaving a gaping hole where the wall had been. My dresser listed dangerously on the edge, then plunged four floors to the street below. Snarling, I whipped my gaze to Oz. He dematerialized instantly into a cloud of murky green fog that compacted, narrowed down to a tight stream, and shot out through the opening blasted in the room. I stood there a moment, leveling my breath, waiting while the energy surging through my arm ebbed, until at last it was gone. My legs felt like noodles, and my hands were trembling. So much for my warding abilities. They'd failed to keep out both Old God and Fay. Push come to shove, I might end up having to sleep on the heavily warded private residence levels of Chester's. And I so didn't want to do that. Then again, I had no idea if they were warded against gods. I pushed the sleeve of my tee up and inspected myself. My arm was black all the way up to my shoulder, with thin tentacles of dark veins spreading across my left collarbone. I let the sleeve drop and looked out over my bed into the pale morning beyond where a sea of rooftops stretched, and farther out, the white caps of a slate-grey ocean. A heavy drizzle had begun to fall, and a sudden breeze gusted rain in, soaking my fluffy white comforter. I rolled my eyes. My bedroom had been through hell in the past few hours, but every rain cloud really did have a silver lining. At least it didn't smell so bad anymore. Assassin. When I was 9 years old, Rowena told me a dangerous cast of Fae had infiltrated our city. Slender, diaphanous, beautiful, with a cloud of gossamer hair and dainty features, they were capable of slipping inside a human and taking over their limbs and lives completely. Once they assumed a human skin, they were no longer detectable to she-seers, and thus camouflaged, vanished forever, beyond our reach, to prey endlessly upon our race. This made them a most deadly threat to our order, she told me in a hushed voice, who could possess her charges at the Abbey at any time. In fact, she confided, they had. But, and there was always a but with the old bitch, she had a special charm that she, and she alone, as Grand Mistress of She-Seers, could employ to see inside a person to the despicable life-stealing Fae within. At 9, nothing seemed far-fetched to me. I'd fully expected to find the world beyond my cage as densely populated by superheroes and villains as my world on the telly. For nearly a year, Rowena steered me down the corridors of our abbey as she inspected her girls, guided me out into the streets and alleys and businesses where we hunted the dastardly villains. A secret team of two, tasked with a great secret mission that made me feel important and good. And when she'd identify a gripper, with a charm that never worked for me, we'd return to her office at the Abbey where, with great gravity and ceremony, she'd place the luminous sword of light across my upturned palms and command me to save our order, perhaps even our world. She taught me to be quick and stealthy about it. She told me how and where to stab and slice and kill. No one suspects a child, not even when they carry a sword. Most thought it a toy. I rarely needed to employ extreme velocity to complete my mission. It was easy to get close. Adults fret over lost, crying children. Do whatever you must to save our world. No deceit or ploy unjust, she'd taught me. The end justifies the means. I've come to understand the means define you. Although they are exceedingly rare, grippers exist. That wasn't a lie. There is, however, no charm that allows anyone to see them. I took 23 lives that year, and I don't know why. Mothers, fathers, daughters, sons. I carved holes in their families, shattering their hearts and their worlds. Perhaps they crossed her in business dealings. Perhaps they looked at her wrong at the post office. Regardless, none of them had been possessed. In one of her journals that I didn't find until I was older, chronicling her own greatness with chilling narcissism, Rowena had penned, "The child was sent to me to address my grievances and right those wrongs done me, controlled by a penurious toy I purchased from a street vendor." I don't know why she stopped, either. Perhaps there were only 23 names on her most hated list. Perhaps so many murders by sword garnered too much attention from the Garda, and she'd not wanted me caught and placed behind bars. Though she'd instructed me to hide the corpses, many were eventually found. The universe has a way of betraying those secrets we endeavor to hold near. The day I learned what I'd done, I decided there were only three courses of action open to me. Kill myself, because I was a monster too. Live the rest of my life hating myself, unable to ever atone, consumed by a heart of darkness that would cast no light into a world that badly needed some. Or lock the past up in a box with those other murders and carry a heart as pure as it had once been into the present, determined to do better, inscribing the Latin motto on the tatters of my soul. Actus me in vito factus non est meus actus. Acts done by my body, against my will, are not my acts. I knew each of my victims' names, and was able to locate most of their families. I protect them still. 6. High voltage, the unforgettable sound. I parked my motorcycle in front of the Abbey, grabbed the backpack that held a change of clothing for later, and loped into the front entrance of the ancient fortress, wearing ripped jeans, boots, and a white tank top that did nothing to conceal what was wrong with my arm. I wasn't going to hide whatever was happening to me. Isolated soldiers are a sniper's favorite target. My sword was slung over my back, knives in my boots, but in deference to the children on the estate, I carry no guns inside those walls. I can't bear the thought of an innocent coming to harm as a result of my carelessness. I love Arlington Abbey. With accommodations for 1,000 she-seers, the fortress is riddled with secret passages behind bookcases and fireplaces, has dozens of concealed nooks and cubbies, and has always held an air of irresistible mystery to me. From the meditation pavilion, hemmed by shaped topiary that legend claims once lived and breathed, protecting the abbey, to the elaborate maze that spans 7 acres near the lake, it was once a badly run mother house for women trained to be reclusive, cowed, and uncertain. Things have changed. We train, we fight, we get dirty and bloody and push each other harder all the time. The abbey's filled to capacity, with a waiting list 1 mile long to get in. Entry-level she-seers, initiates, can spend anywhere from 2 to 10 years in training as they learn to use their gifts. Those gifts we've been seeing since the Song of Making restored magic to our world, are unlike anything we've encountered before. Apprentices, who've achieved a level of proficiency sufficient to pass a series of difficult tests, will spend another few years in additional training. Some might never graduate to the final level. The adepts, those of us who've harnessed our gifts and serve as trainers for the initiates and apprentices. Then there's the Shedon, the council of popularly elected she-seers that govern the abbey. The mother house is no longer a tyrannical prison of coercion and tightly controlled skewed press. In my youth, I'd blast through those corridors at full throttle, feared and distrusted by everyone around me. I used to hate that, seeing the fear. It made me feel alone. But I've galvanized my truths. Life is funny. It makes you choose sides all the time. Fearless people are outsiders. The fearful have many places to belong. They're the fluffy white sheep that stick close to the shepherds, let others feed, fatten, and shear them. and spiral in a tight, panicked knot if a wolf draws near. When I'm surrounded by that herd, I can't understand the conversation that usually goes something like this. I'm scared. What do you think we should do?
I don't know. What do you think we should do?
I don't know. Let's ask somebody else. Panic ensues. Bah! I'm the dingy grey sheep. The one no one wants to shear and everyone forgets to feed. The one that gets pissed off and, with plumes of steam shooting from my ears, rather than lazing in the sun under the care of a master I have no guarantee knows how to survive any better than me, goes trotting off alone to hunt for wolf-slaying weapons. I'd rather be fearless and criticised than fearful and approved of. That's the bloody choice sometimes. Still, I've learned in recent years to bleach my coat. The better to blend. And when they aren't looking, I'm as grey as I need to be. It's easier on all of us that way. I think that's what Riordan does too. Concealing his inner beast with casual elegance behind cool grey eyes. I miss him. When I let myself think about him. Which is never. Today I stalked down vaulted stone corridors to the library, offering greetings and returning smiles. Though many of the women stared at my arm, it was without censure, only a lifting of brows and curious meeting of my eyes. When Shazam hadn't returned by the time I awakened from a quick nap on the sofa, I packed up and headed out to start my day. He has a way of finding me wherever I go, and I suspect he's often perched above me in a higher dimension, manifesting when he feels like it. I understand the need for time alone, and don't normally pressure him. But after last night's escapade, once he appeared again, I planned to do everything in my power to keep him engaged and by my side. "Hey, Cat," I said as I entered the library. The tall, athletic brunette glanced up from a computer screen and swept me with a level grey gaze. "Ugh, and it's grown." Cat was part of the She-Don, her she-seer gift, a dangerously sensitive empathy. Possessing the ability to read the emotions of those around her at their truest level, I've found her incapable of lying. "What do you feel? Read me." I dropped over the back of a chair and sat down across the table from her. She stared at me a long moment, eyes drifting out of focus, then said lightly, "You feel like you always do." "And how's that?" "Like Danny. Light and energy. A bubbling sense of humour, an exacting sense of personal responsibility and justice, and a heart the size of Ireland." She was silent a moment, then added, "And many, many private vaults that never open to see the light of day." My eyes narrowed. "Can you get in them?" "No." "That means you've tried."
"I have."
An unwilling smile tugged at my lips, as I thought both, "How dare you?" and "Good for you." She'd changed, toughened, moved beyond courtesy to necessity. We live in hard times. You can't keep your blades sharp by polishing them with a chamois. You have to sharpen them on stone. "The day I get in, I'll tell you. And the moment I do, I'll back out without looking around. I've no desire to know the secrets you've no desire to tell me, Danny. But the vaults of your mind are the greatest challenge I've found." And would forever remain that challenge. She wouldn't get in. I restructure my brain regularly and meticulously, planting decoys everywhere. Not even Riordan got very far past the surface. I changed the subject. "I had a visitor last night. Actually, two. 9, if you counted the palace cats, which I didn't, and hoped never to smell again." As I filled her in on what happened, she listened intently. "The old gods," she finally murmured. "At war with the Fae? Bloody hell, does it never end?"
"Mummy said a bad word,"
came a breathless little girl voice from behind Cat. Her daughter Ray peeked around her shoulder, and I crinkled my nose at her and smiled. Usually when I first see the dazzling ray of sunshine, child, I catch her up in my arms, kick us both into the slipstream, and twirl her around in a dizzying, starry explosion of light, because I live to hear her unfettered belly laugh. but from the way she was peeping at me, I could tell she was in a hide-and-seek mood today. I'd chase her later, up and down halls, perhaps into the maze behind the abbey.
Shazzy?
She asked hopefully, luminous dark eyes rounding with excitement. On a walkabout, I said, and her face fell. Ray adored Shazam, and the feeling was mutual. When, a few years back, Cat suddenly had a baby, seemingly out of nowhere, we'd all been shocked. We had no idea who the father was, although many believed it was her childhood love, Sean O'Banion, who, like Christian and Inspector Jane, had begun transforming into a fey prince when the original princes were killed. One of the many unpredictable things about the fey race was, on the rare occasion the princes or princesses were killed, the nearest raw matter, mortal or fey, that met some mysterious requirement, was selected to begin a painful transformation. Mac told me the Unseelie King said the fey were like starfish and would always regrow essential parts. Lesser fey weren't considered essential. The High Court was. Unlike Jane, Sean O'Banion had turned Unseelie and hadn't been seen for years. Cat never offered the name of Ray's father, and we didn't ask. She made it clear it didn't matter. Ray was her daughter, end of subject. Whatever she-seer gifts the girl possessed hadn't yet begun to manifest. Ray certainly looked like she might be Sean's, with raven curls, brown eyes flecked with amber, and the complexion of a black Irishman's daughter. I wasn't interesting enough without Shazam to keep the curious, energetic child's attention today, and Ray ambled off to play as Cat opened a Word document and made notes about our conversation, nudging me for as much detail as I could recall. And this Oz mentioned another who might come for the sword? I nodded. But no name? I shook my head. She studied me a moment, then... Do you believe the sword would be safer with a fey? I said irritably, I'm half tempted to give it to the strongest god I can find and let the races kill each other. Cat sucked in a breath. I raised both hands in placation, one pale Irish, the other dark as ebony. But I won't. Mac's queen. And I'd die before I'd put a weapon into the hands of someone who might hurt her. She and I had been through so much together. She was the sister I'd never had. I don't think that's the answer, Cat. I was able to protect it last night. If I hadn't been, I'd be open to the possibility, especially if I could somehow get it to Mac. I trusted neither gods nor the Fae with one of the only two hallowed weapons capable of ending an immortal life. Any Fae who got their hands on it could amass an army and go to war against their queen, and many of them despised the human who'd been chosen as their ruler's successor. Perhaps the sword is right where it needs to be, and this power is awakening so I can keep it safe. Cat said dryly, Or perhaps it's merely coincidental, and our world's gone as mad as it seems while we bumble about foolishly trying to ascribe patterns to chaos. I laughed. There was that. The wish, Danny. Have you any idea what Oz meant? I'd tried to figure it out on the ride here, reflecting on the moment I'd picked up the spelled item. I'd responded primarily with raw emotion, secondarily with actual thought. Oz might have sorted through a dozen half-formed desires and selected whichever one he thought might bite me in the ass the hardest. I shook my head and said grimly, No clue. Cat, what do you think about this god business? I read the Book of Invasions a long time ago and found it to be... I try not to insult anyone else's beliefs. I dangle first and let them finish, see how they go about it. I've learned diplomacy. It doesn't come easy to me, so I like to practice when I can. Pure tripe, she said with a wry smile. At the very least, heavily redacted with enormous poetic license taken, I agreed. Do you think these gods might be the reality of the stories of the ancient Fomorians, awakened by the song? It's certainly a theory worth exploring. According to the Book of Invasions, the Fomorians battled the Tuatha Dé Danann were widely regarded as monsters, and were driven into the sea, never to be seen again. But the timetable of those events was severely condensed to reconcile history with Christianity, forcing the entire period from creation of the world to the Middle Ages to fit within the events of the Bible. I have long suspected those events happened far longer ago than we can imagine. History is murky business, rewritten again and again until the original story is lost to us. That's why it's critical we translate our ancient scrolls. They'll be closer to truth than anything scribed in the past few thousand years, influenced by political and religious agendas. We've been hearing stories from all over Ireland. People in rural areas have encountered beings they claimed have fae-like powers. Were you able to sense Oz with your she-seer senses? I shook my head grimly. No. My gut got nothing. My brain registered empirical evidence that made me believe he wasn't human. She nodded again and rose, gathering her notes. I'll meet with the Shedon, pass on the news, see what they know. I kicked back in the chair, propped my boots on the table, grabbed the latest stack of translations, and began to read. Nothing, I muttered several hours later. Bloody nothing. We have no way of determining what the books and scrolls are about before we begin to translate them. Most of them have no titles, Bridget said mildly, head bent close to a tiny journal in her hands. In her late 40s, streaks of grey feathered her short, dark hair. The day shift of translators had settled in at the long, wide table with me shortly after I'd begun reading. True, agreed 17-year-old Fallon, whose specialty was ancient dialects. She'd come to us 5 months ago, bearing a sealed letter from a sister house in Wales, beseeching us to train her, as she'd recently developed latent powers they'd no experience with. Chameleon-like, she'd begun melting into her surroundings. The strength of 5 men infused her petite frame, and I suspected from how quickly and silently she could move that she might one day be able to join me in the slipstream. Glossy chestnut hair swept her shoulders, framing a face wide through the cheekbones that tapered to a broad jaw before narrowing sharply to a pointed chin. Aquamarine eyes narrowed with frustration as she added, And we suspect Rowena took the most important books. Saints know where she hid them. Bridget said, The council delegated a team to begin exploring the underneath next week. Perhaps we'll find a stash there. Anything discovered underground will get translated first, she assured me. 2 years I've been waiting to hear those words. We were finally going to turn our attention to the unexplored realm beneath the fortress. Like a Janus head, the abbey was split into halves. The upstairs, which held fascinating mysteries of the mostly non-deadly kind, and the underneath, rumored to hold secrets too powerful, too terrible for anyone to know. The council had long been wary of the underneath. The Shisa Du was once contained in that subterranean maze. Rowena had forbidden anyone to enter the underneath, but I'd been there. Once. Years ago. Tailing her past her many wards and traps. Lingering to kill the fae she'd been nibbling on, for who knew how long, to increase her power and extend her lifespan. I'd got glimpses of countless snaking passageways, heavily locked and warded doors, vaulting caverns, and I'd only been on a single level. I'd passed dozens of curved stone stairwells spiraling down to seemingly bottomless pits. I'd hungered to explore it further once she was gone, but I'd committed to our order and towed the council's line, which was, Si vis pacem, para bellum. If you want peace, prepare for war. We'd focused on locating the most powerful she-seers, testing and training them while they monitored Ireland, the world beyond. We knew it wasn't over, and wouldn't be so long as the wall between our world and Faerie was down. Our races coexisted in a powder keg, where the slightest spark could make everything blow. If Mac were unable to gain control of the immortal race, we'd be right back where we started, slaughtering each other in our quest for control of the world. Who's heading the team? I asked Bridget. Enyo, she said. I approved the choice. Born in a war zone in Lebanon, Enyo had been a soldier long before she'd found us. Smart, driven, and hungry for challenge, she was the perfect choice. I looked forward to spending time with her while we explored. I bristled with anticipation. I would be on that team. I glanced at the clock above the fireplace, noted the time, and shoved back in my chair to head back to Dublin for an appointment I'd made that morning. At the same time, Bridget, who I'd not realized had gotten up and was now behind me, leaned over my shoulder to add another page to my stack for when I returned. We collided. Or rather, her forearm brushed my left shoulder. Raw high voltage exploded from my arm with a thunderous boom, and my skin crackled with energy. There was the sudden stench of burning hair, followed by popping sounds, met with a high-pitched scream that terminated as swiftly as it had begun. Then there was the racket of furniture crashing to the floor, and what sounded like one of the old massive bookcases behind me splintering and chilling wet splats. Then, the stillest of silences. Half out of my chair, I froze. Hands splayed on the table. Fallon was staring past me, mouth gaping on a silent O, eyes wide with shock and horror. I couldn't make myself move for a long moment, just stood there. Muscles flexed to move, but not obeying my command. My legs were noodles again, my hands shaking. I'd felt the enormity of what had flared to instant life inside me. I'd seen what it had done to my bedroom wall this morning. Perhaps it had simply knocked her out. I hadn't intended any harm, quite the opposite. Nor had I flung my hand, as I did with Jane, or even moved it at all. She'd merely brushed the bare skin of her forearm against the bare skin of my shoulder. "Fallon," I begged with my eyes, "say it's not true. Say she's okay." The apprentice began to hyperventilate, gulping air, unable to make a sound. Shoulders shaking, tears spilled from her eyes. I slumped back into my chair, doubled over and puked violently, retching the contents of my stomach on the floor until nothing but a thin stream of bile dribbled from my chin. I didn't need to look behind me to know Bridget was dead. 7. Secluded in a marker stone, not only deadlier, but much smarter too. Confronted by extreme emotion, I box it and take action. Do something, anything, whatever most immediately needs to be done. My heart was screaming, "You killed Bridget! You're a liability, dangerous to your friends. Run away and hide because you're a monster. And as your mom liked to say so often at the end, the world would be better off if you'd never been born." My brain said with cool efficiency, "You made this mess, clean it up." I stumbled into my chair, knocking it over, yanked it back up, and locked my knees and began to collect parts and assemble them in a small, neat arrangement. Normally, as soon as I see Ray, I catch her up in my arms, my deadly killing embrace. I begged every god to forgive me for killing Bridget, and saying to every god that it hadn't been Ray. Then I begged every god to forgive me for making such a distinction, as I picked up pieces with only my right hand, because I had no idea what would happen if I touched them with my left, and no desire to find out. Holding what appeared to be a fragment of the soft-spoken, effortlessly kind woman's pale, bloody arm, I muttered, "I did this." Unaware I'd spoken aloud until Fallon snapped, "Danny, stop it. It wasn't your fault. It was an accident. And for God's sake, stop trying to put her back together." I hadn't realized I was. I carefully placed part of Bridget's hand and three fingers to the right of the macabre puzzle I was working. The door flew open and I spun toward it, vibrating, shivering, dangerously close to losing control and vanishing in the slipstream. I hungered to disappear, escape gazes certain to condemn. I fisted my hands at my sides, right hand dripping blood, left hand ice cold, and forced myself to breathe in a rhythm I'd perfected Silverside when sniping hostile targets. Inflate gut, wave the breath up to my chest, breathe out. Stop breathing. Shoot. Repeat. There's a still silent, flawless dimension that exists on the trigger of a gun, and I could live in that place. It feels good there. Unbreathing. Remote. I never miss a shot. Cat stood in the doorway. Bridget's pain ended as swiftly as it had begun. But mine was a mushroom cloud of toxic emotion she must have felt and come running to discern the cause. She took stock of me, assessed Fallon, squared her shoulders, and glanced left at the demolished bookcase, the bits of bone and flesh, the mangled remains of Bridget. I gave her enormous kudos that she didn't double over and puke as I wiped the last bit of bile from my chin. "What happened?" she said quietly. "I killed..." "Shut up, Danny," Fallon said sharply as she moved to join me, but not too close. She stopped a few feet away. "Danny didn't kill Bridget," she told Kat. "Bridget bent over her left shoulder as Danny was standing up. The black part of her is dangerous, and she didn't know it." "How can you exonerate me? She's dead." "How can you convict yourself?" Fallon retorted, eyes flashing. "It was an accident. I saw the entire thing. You had no idea she was behind you. You had no idea anything about you was dangerous." "I should have known." "How could you know? It's my arm. That makes it my fault." "Stop it, Danny," Kat said quietly. "You won't be carrying this one too." "Yes, I would. But saying so would only make Kat and Fallon work harder to excuse me." "Kat, what if I'd picked up Ray like I usually do?" My voice broke on the words at the same time my knees gave out. I sank to the floor, tucked my head in my arms, half expecting my own head to blow up, fighting tears. I would weep, but in private, alone. I would dance until I was too exhausted to hold it in any longer. Then I would cry. And deal, like I always do. "Get buckets of hot soapy water and trash bags," Kat instructed Fallon. "Bring mops, Enyo, and a few of the adepts." I glanced up and watched Fallon leave with a sharp stab of pride. An apprentice, she'd not fallen apart. She'd lost it for a moment, then become the warrior that was needed. Kat closed the door behind her, moved into the room and sank to her knees a few feet from me. "I take you in my arms and comfort you, but we seem to have a wee bit of a problem." "A wee bit," I mocked darkly. "I just killed an innocent woman. A good woman with a good life ahead of her. Done, gone, end of story, thanks to me." "I know some of what Rowena did to you." I stiffened. "I know a truth. Most people can't handle the truths of my life." "The She-Seers perform surgery on our world with anesthesia when at all possible, employing a deft technique. I hack out the cancerous spots in brutal fashion, armed with whatever weapon is handy. The way I was taught. The way I did it the first time. I began lying young. Made compartments to store them all in, to keep track. Lying is a pain in the ass. It complicates the brain, mandates the creation of more files, consuming valuable space." "She kept a hidden cache in her suite. When I stayed there, I discovered a collection beneath a floorboard. Some were maps of the Abbey, which will prove useful as we explore beneath. There were two journals." I narrowed my eyes, searching her gaze. How much did she know? "Pawns are not to blame for the actions of kings. Children are not to blame for the atrocities of adults. You know now that your arm has become dangerous. That information was gained at a terrible price, but..." She said in a voice that was laced with steel. "Do not damage yourself further than the world already damaged you. You're becoming something powerful. Don't abort that birth because of an accident. We live in a time fraught with peril, abilities we don't understand. Changes occurring so quickly, it's impossible to keep up. Put this in one of your vaults. War is coming. We've both been feeling that dark wind blowing down on us for a long time. Soldier up. This new gift of yours may be precisely the thing we need to tip the balance of the future in our favor. I knew Bridget's death was an accident. I'd never have harmed her. And I didn't know it was dangerous to touch me. But this was different than the actions done by me against my will. This had happened due to my carelessness. I'd assumed something about my arm with no basis for that assumption. I'd assume I was safe to be around. I wasn't. And let's be brutally honest here, I've never been to one degree or another. That's why my mom locked me in a cage in the first place. That's why I miss my crew so much. They aren't human. They're much less breakable. Cat whispered, "Ugh, so much pain." She was silent a moment, then said sternly, "And that's the damage that was done to you unfairly. Your mother gave up. Instead of fighting, she panicked. It wasn't you, it was her. Don't let those voices win. You're not the wrong one or the bad one." "When did you become a bloody mind reader?" "I'm not." She paused, then said carefully, "Castillo taught me a few things." I said incredulously, "Castillo? The one that speaks to no one?" I knew she'd worked out with him at Chester's, but he'd taught her other things too. I'd give my right arm for lessons from one of the nine, preferably my left at this point, if someone would take the damn thing. "Accept what happened. Grieve. But do it gently. You'd never have harmed Bridget. You can't undo it. Logic dictates you incorporate the lesson and move on." Same advice and absolution I'd have given to another. Same grace I never permit myself. A life ended. Because of me. Christ, her last breath was the one she'd breathed as she'd stood behind me. She had a boyfriend, she had dreams. The others will blame me. I'd be walking corridors of condemnation again. Some will, especially those who envy your gifts, and there are many. Living legends have long been targets for small minds. You won't listen to them. You'll let it roll off you and continue doing all you can to help our world and our people. Such is the price of power. Great power comes at great price. And you, Danny, my love, have always been strong enough to pay it. Fallon bustled into the library then with Enyo and four adepts, buckets of soapy water, trash bags, and cloths. We soldiered up and began cleaning the remains from the walls and floor in grim silence. I took the long, circuitous way home, knowing I'd only sit staring, playing Bridget's death through my mind, seeing images of the bits and pieces of her being reassembled into a bloody hole that could never be made whole again. There were many things I should do, as dusk took my city. At the moment, I was sitting on my idling bike in the empty lot above Chester's nightclub. The rubble littering the pavement was hauled off years ago by the Dublin cleanup crew, leaving only a fractured concrete surface with deep, jagged cracks, and a heavy, warded trapdoor. Not, however, too heavily warded for me. And besides, I'd found the back way in 2 years ago. That was the night I'd discovered, locked in a storage room deep beneath the club, a small printing press, and reams of paper. I also found the initials RKS at the bottom of a pile of legal documents, granting Riordan title to properties all over Dublin. I'd entertained myself endlessly trying to guess his last name. Depending on my mood, they'd range from exotic and sexy to absurd. How many dragons had the man launched into my sky for me? trying to keep me too busy to get myself killed. The Dublin Daily was once the bane of my existence, occupying hours of my time, inspiring me to write smarter, try harder, take myself more seriously. It and We Care, which I sometimes suspected he'd created as well, had kept me fighting faceless entities rather than racing out into the streets, seeking more tangible, deadly foes. "Come back already?" I muttered at the empty lot. I missed him, and the simple way he saw me, without any filters. I missed feeling the way I felt around him. He was gasoline to my fire, matches to my dynamite. He'd enjoyed my fire, my dynamite. And whether I'd liked it or not, and most of the time I hadn't, he'd kept me from blowing myself or too many others up with it. Life wasn't the same without him around. Although I love my city, my life, Dublin without the Nine, without Mac and Barons, is a big top circus without a single lion, tiger, or bear. Not even elephants. Just chimps, clowns, and sheep. Oodles and oodles of sheep. And snakes. Those are the Fae. I used to like being the only superhero in town. Ugh, I'm so over that. Countless were the times I'd considered calling him on my cell phone. Countless were the times I'd shoved it back in my pocket, accepting his absence for what it was. A desire to be somewhere else that was not with me. The man who'd launched my dragons didn't care enough to call or text me a single time in over 2 years to see how I was doing. Or if I was even still alive. Leaving was one thing. Never checking in was unforgivable. Rotten purgatory, Riordan, I growled as I put my bike in gear. Shaz and I have code names for our many residences. I doubt I need them. I suspect he can find me anywhere, anytime he wants, and thinks it's funny to humor me by pretending to read the notes I scrawl telling him where I am. Before I'd left this morning, I scribbled the word Sanctuary across the bedroom wall in Sharpie. An enemy would have no idea what it meant. Shazam would know he'd find me in the penthouse flat that occupied the top floor of a building on the north side of the River Liffey. I prefer to live up high, with a clear view of my city below. On those rare occasions I'm not patrolling at night, I love to sit on the fire escape, beyond the tall arched windows that line the wall floor to ceiling, and watch the river slide by, the lights twinkling like fallen stars in the streets. Sanctuary is a study in greys and blacks and whites, the most colourless of my abodes. I crave its Spartan elegance when something's bothering me. Eschewing the distracting brightness of the world to think surrounded by soothing monotones. I dislike doing anything uniform or predictable that might allow an enemy to track me. Yet a risky number of my residences are penthouses, as they afford tall windows and vaulted ceilings. I accept the liability in exchange for space, room to breathe, and a place to burn off restless energy. In Sanctuary's enormous living room that's void of all furniture, on a polished black floor that I can see my own reflection in, facing a wall of windows, with a line of fire burning behind glass at my back, on hard nights in my chronic town, I dance like I once danced on another world, beneath three full moons, abandoned to a song only I can hear. I dance to get it all out, the emotion that builds up inside me. I dance until, exhausted, often weeping, I sleep. My kitchen is a sleek, modern affair of quartz, chrome, and black marble floors. Those floors spill throughout the entire flat and are easy to mop blood from. Usually when I seek sanctuary, I'm bleeding. Tonight there was no blood, just an arm as black as my floors. Shazam was sprawled fatly across the ivory island, occupying half of it, tearing flesh off the skull of... Is that a pig? I said disbelievingly. You ate an entire pig. From the amount of blood staining the counters, dripping down the sides, and the size of the hooves he'd left uneaten, it was a full-grown pig, too. Shrugging, he said nothing, only studied a distant space in the air and licked innocently at a paw, tail twitching with audible thumps against the quartz. Good grief. You might have at least saved me a flank of bacon.